Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are going to be talking about a couple of topics that are very much top of mind, for me at least at the moment, and I think should be for you as well. One involves the prospect of the Biden administration embroiling the United States, its military personnel specifically, but us as well, in Gaza to protect Hamas against Israel. Hard to believe, but that seems to be in the offing. Secondly, we're going to talk about another front that seems to be in the process of being opened. The strategic arson of Xi Jinping is what I call it, out in the Philippines. And the man who's going to help us address both of these topics is one of our very, very valued colleagues, as well as great resources here at Securing America. His name is Chuck DeVore. He rose through the ranks of the United States Army's Reserves and National Guard to the exalted position of a lieutenant colonel. But in addition to all of that, he became a member of the State Assembly of California before he had the great idea of bugging out of California and transplanting to Texas, where all things are better. He is now the chief of national initiatives at a marvelous organization, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, the author of, among other things, The Crisis of the House Never United, and an updated online accessible version of a book that he wrote many years ago entitled China Attacks. It also is now called China Attacks 2024, which is very much relevant to the topics at hand. Chuck, it's great to have you back, my friend. Welcome.
It's good to be with you, Frank. And Frank, I didn't bug out from California. It was a tactical repositioning.
Let's
set the record straight.
That's what I meant to say, of course. As Ronald Reagan famously said, California left you, right?
That's right.
Anyway, the point is, Chuck, you are doing a more really important work in Texas, and we're delighted to have a chance to visit with you. I want to take advantage of your military expertise as well as your considerable understanding of national security more broadly. This idea that the United States is going to put a port, a temporary port, using your beloved Army's assets, a substantial proportion of their assets, as it happens, for this sort of work, in Gaza seems to me to be ill-considered in the extreme. And the fact that there's been no formal discussion of this, let alone debate or vote for it, is further troubling. But what are your thoughts if something on the order of 30 to 50%, according to our friend John Mills, of the Army's capacity to put ports into places might need that capacity in place like the Pacific if China, right, in fact, attacks. But is this a good idea on any count, do you think?
Right. So I think four things immediately jump to my mind, some more political, some more practical. On the practical side, the fact is that since the Cold War, we've allowed our logistics capabilities to significantly atrophy, not just in the Army, but of course, with the Navy as well. As we've been paying for combat systems, we seem to forget that we're a global power. And unless you intend to use those systems just in the United States or in nearby North America, it's going to take a lot of logistics support to be able to use those weapon systems. The second thing is that this equipment is having to cross the Atlantic under its own power. In the past, of course, it would have been loaded up on a large ship and very quickly ported across the Atlantic. We don't have those capabilities anymore in the active force. We've allowed a lot of that to atrophy as well. The third issue goes to, is this even wise policy? What are we doing in Gaza? Why build a port? Why, you know, what are we trying to do in the region? Is it going to be helpful to have Israel in this war on terms favorable to its national security, which I would define as the destruction of Hamas, or is it going to somehow prevent that? And then lastly, I'm quite concerned about a redo of what we saw in 1983, when Ronald Reagan deployed U.S. military forces to Lebanon to rescue Yasser Arafat and the Palestine Liberation Organization from Israel and from strife in Lebanon, which they triggered in large part. And you ended up with the Beirut Barracks bombing, which, of course, we now know was planned and executed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so when you have such a high-profile target sitting out there in the open ocean right along the coastline, the question that I would ask is, why wouldn't they attack Americans? Why, you know, what would they think that they might gain?
Right. And there was another episode that I thought you were going to touch on, Chuck, of U.S. military personnel almost coming to blows with Israelis in connection with some of those operations in Lebanon. And, you know, it seems as though this could only have been brought to fruition by somebody who wanted to save Hamas and harm the U.S. relationship with Israel. And one such person I know is Samantha Power. She's currently the director of the U.S. Agency for International Development. And I've seen press reports, Chuck, that it's her idea to have not only this go forward, but also to have as folks who will be managing this port, Qatar, and specifically a company based there owned by Hamas, right, called Al-Hizri. I mean, this, to the extent there is a U.S. policy towards the Middle East, it seems as though this can only be described as of a piece with one of the more harebrained notions in our history, which is that we want to do business with Iran and not Israel. We want to have friendly relations with terrorists trying to destroy our ally, not that ally. Unless I'm missing something, I would think this really ought not to go forward, this port or any of its related decisions, do you think?
Right. So I see this as a continuation of the Obama-era policy towards Iran and towards Israel and the broader Middle East. You saw, of course, hints of that when Biden was running for president and he attacked Saudi Arabia and said it was a pariah state and that they would be shifting relations, strongly disagreed with former President Trump's policies in the region, including the highly successful Abraham Accords. And so they see, Obama and his team saw, Iran as a counterbalance to Israel, which I suppose after a fashion you could say that it is. But to what end? Why would you think that? That's insane. It's foolish. It's stupid. And as Biden rolled back the maximum pressure campaign of President Trump that was highly effective in starving the Iranian military of resources, of starving them of the money they needed for their broader terrorist actions, and of course their uranium enrichment program with the hundreds of centrifuges they need, all of that now has been lost. And you see Iran rapidly rebounding from 4 years of steady policy under Trump to this new very ill-considered policy under Biden.
Well, especially
to see this peer as a part of that policy.
Yeah, amen, Chuck. But on top of it all, I think it's a correct total as of now, at least. Some $26 billion has been poured by this administration into Iranian coffers during this period. Some of it after October 7th,
right,
when Iranian proxies attacked Israel. I mean, this is just beyond comprehension, unless it's just about betraying
right.
our
it's
country and our national interests.
Order.
Yeah. Chuck, we have to take a short break. I just want to say we'll be talking a little bit more about this port business with Steve Bryan, one of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. I hope you'll stay tuned for that. Drawing upon the research and work we're doing, including on this port, we'll have some more of it out shortly. We urge you to support that work at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. You're going to find this report very, very interesting, and we'll be talking about it shortly. Chuck, stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on the Pacific side of the war we're now facing. I call it World War G. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The loss of 7 individuals tragically killed by Israeli forces while feeding Palestinians in Gaza has prompted other aid organizations to suspend operations until, we're told, they are satisfied it's safe. Memo to all such organizations, Gaza is not safe. It is a war zone in which local and foreign civilians are at unavoidably some risk. That's substantially because Israel is fighting an enemy that intensifies that risk by using such civilians as not just human shields, but as weapons. The more killed, the better for the information warfare Hamas terrorists are counting on to survive. There are only two ways truly to end the suffering of non-combatants in this war. Hamas can unconditionally surrender or be decisively defeated. Any other outcome is a formula for far more death and destruction of innocents throughout the Middle East and, inevitably, here. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with our friend Chuck DeVore, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army retired. He is a man who has distinguished himself in a number of capacities, but one that's particularly admired is his perspicacity, his looking over the horizon. Notably, in a book that he wrote many years ago, China Attacks, and he's updating it now, China Attacks. Chuck, how do people go about finding your unfolding online book,
China Attacks 2024? Just go to Amazon or just put my name in quotes on Google, Chuck DeVore, and you'll find it.
It'll pop up. Good. So, Chuck, speaking of China Attacks, it is attacking elements of our ally, the Philippines, at the moment. This has not gotten nearly the attention that I think it deserves, especially since we have a treaty relationship with the Filipinos that could, at any moment, kick in. Talk us through the nature of, well, first of all, the relationship we have with the Philippines now, as well as what the Chinese are up to.
Right. So our relationship with the Philippines is now kind of returning to its historic warmth that you have seen for many, many decades. It was a little chilly there for a while with the former President Duterte. But now under Aquino, it's, I think, back to kind of the what's been traditional.
There was a nasty period when we were told we weren't really welcome there. And we Subic Bay and so on.
And by the way, they ejected us, I think, only by one vote in their national legislature. So it's not like it was a unanimous decision. So what's been going on since the Obama administration really retreated in the face of this bold Chinese effort to militarize and to essentially destroy, to wreak amazing amounts of environmental damage on these rocks and reefs and atolls in the South China Sea, very far from the Chinese mainland, completely out of their exclusive economic zone and in the exclusive economic zones of other nations like Vietnam and the Philippines and Malaysia. Once that started to happen, you saw the Philippines very quickly decide, hey, you know, we're not going to let this happen on our watch. And so they purposefully grounded a World War II era landing ship in Scarborough Reef, and they've been maintaining it ever since. The thing is rusting. It's falling apart. I really feel for the sailors that are having to man this thing. And what the Chinese have been doing in recent times is trying to prevent the resupply missions from getting out and providing the men on this outpost with water and batteries and other consumables, you know, food that they need to continue to operate. And so what they're doing, Frank, is getting pretty violent with very high power water cannons. They've injured a number of Philippine personnel. They've damaged ships. And, you know, you get a powerful enough water cannon, you can do some serious damage. In fact, were I Secretary of Defense or President, one of the things I'd recommend is outfitting a ship with a water cannon so powerful you could just cut right through metal, and you'd pull up right next to one of these Chinese vessels, and you'd just open it up like a can of sardines right at the waterline and see it capsize in a minute. Say, well, what are you complaining about? It's just a water cannon.
Just a water cannon. Yeah. I'm surprised they haven't done it themselves, the Chicoms.
Right. Yeah, right. I guess I shouldn't give them the idea.
The question that occurs is the provocations that the Chinese are engaged in are clearly intentional. I, as you know, we've talked about this on any number of occasions, Chuck, believe that Xi Jinping is deliberately sort of igniting, if you will, conflagrations around the world in a kind of strategic arson. The ultimate purpose of which is to, I think, distract us, deplete our resources, divert them for sure, from the defense of Taiwan, which, as you've talked about in your novel, is the immediate object of their ambitions. What do you think is the likelihood that there will, in fact, be open hostilities between the Filipinos and the Chinese, and will we be drawn in as a result?
Yeah, I think the likelihood is increasing by the hour. You certainly see just recently a high-ranking U.S. naval officer just warned the Chinese that if they end up killing a Philippine service member, that that would trigger the treaty between the U.S. and the Philippines for mutual aid. Now, I think that China may be heading toward this direction just to test us, right? This is somebody's going to lose face. Either they're going to stop short of killing somebody at sea, or they do, and they're going to expect us not to do anything. Now, Frank, on top of that, you know, you talk about the strategic arson. I am quite alarmed at rhetoric I saw out of China just in the last day or two, which was blaming Ukraine for that recent ISIS terror attack on the Crocus concert venue in Russia, and made other claims that were quite specious about Ukraine that made me think that what China is doing is beginning to stitch together the rationale for a formal alliance with Putin's Russia. And when you look at that sort of language, while at the same time, China seems to be very diligently working on creating a casus belli, a reason for war with the Philippines and secondarily with Japan and of course, Taiwan, it just seems to me that we're on a track right now that is we're distracted elsewhere with this ridiculous pier and Gaza and these other issues in the Red Sea with the Houthis. It seems to me that things are coming to a boil pretty quickly in the South China Sea and in the reaches of the Pacific on the first island chain.
Yeah. And Chuck, as we've talked about, again, on any number of occasions, one of the other options that Xi clearly has obtained, in part thanks to Joe Biden's destruction of the southern border, not too far from where you reside, is to have the ability to light, if you will, a tinderbox here in the United States. A lot of people have been suspicious about exactly what happened in the Baltimore Harbor incident recently. Whether that was, in fact, anything other than an accident remains to be determined. But it certainly has underscored, as have you, the vulnerability of our critical infrastructure in this country. I'm so pleased that the Texas Public Policy Foundation has been gearing up on the whole issue of our electric grid. And we've long believed that Texas is a place where showing how it can be hardened, if you will, and protected against various kinds of attack is for the nation, because you have your own grid there, of course. This is a place and a time where we might find a hot war starting at any moment as well, is it not?
I do believe so. And of course, part of the challenge with what China has done is a lot of the equipment we've bought from China has back doors installed in it. There's circuitry that aren't part of the original designs that people have determined could be used maliciously. And of course, you have these thousands of individuals of military age that have been coming across the border for the last 14 months now. I asked Governor Abbott about that in an interview late last week, and he is very concerned, and I think rightfully so. At the very least, of course, you have a high youth unemployment rate in China. A lot of these young men may be coming across because the economy in China appears to be collapsing. Of course, we don't really know. But
they're coming across with permission. That's
right.
For sure.
Well, and then the other issue is a lot of them are being sucked into these marijuana grow operations, which the Chinese triads, the organized crime, have taken over in the last year or so. And a lot of these individuals end up being indentured servitude. They have their passports taken away, their cell phones taken away, and they're helping to grow and distribute drugs. Lastly, of course, you have individuals who may be here as part of commando teams to conduct espionage or active sabotage efforts against our grid or other critical infrastructure, even targeted assassinations, I wouldn't rule out.
No, I think that's absolutely right. That might be firstly rather than lastly, but you're absolutely right that that's in the mix. And Chuck, I just think this is such an important time for us to be taking steps to harden our grids. Tomorrow, we're going to have my colleague Tommy Waller and Command Sergeant Major Mike Mabee talking about what needs to be done there in Texas, among other things. So stay tuned for that, folks. Chuck, in the meantime, we'll say thank you for all your service to our country, including that continues today at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. I know you keep it up. Come back to us soon. Stay tuned for more. Steve Bryan is up next, right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back and visiting with, I'm pleased to say, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, one of our senior fellows, Dr. Stephen Bryan. He is a man I've had the privilege of working with and serving alongside of for decades. I shudder to think how long that really is.
But that's kind of scary, Frank.
It's a long time partnership. Steve was, among other things, formerly a Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. He was also a senior congressional staffer and a captain of the defense industry at Finmeccanica America. Steve, thank you so much for joining us as always. It's great to have you with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Frank.
Although the subject that we're going to talk about is not terribly pleasant, I'm afraid.
No.
You have been reporting on and analyzing what is going on in Ukraine. And I'm really quite troubled that what may be headed our way is the defeat of Ukraine at the hands of the
Russians. That's right.
And I want you to explain if that is in fact what's in the offing, and then what do you think comes next?
Well, I do think that the war is, I wouldn't say winding down, the war is proceeding in the favor of the Russians. They're gaining ground in most places. The Ukrainian army is getting worn down very badly, losing lots of equipment, losing a lot of men, huge numbers. They can't sustain it. I think the Europeans are starting to figure that out. What they're trying to figure out is what is an exit strategy. They're getting no help from Washington because Washington is not interested in anything except victory, but there isn't going to be a victory. So I think the Europeans are starting to figure that maybe there's got to be some alternative here. And the latest was Chancellor Olaf Scholz in Germany, saying, you know, well, we're meeting with our colleagues, we're trying to figure out something. So it's clear that that's the track they're starting to get on.
Mm-hmm. And when you say that track, you've had Macron of France talking about actually.
Yeah, he's on his own track.
there is that track. There are tracks that I think still involve continued funding and arms supplies. The Poles, I think, are among those who are still pressing for
that won't do it. There's essentially two alternatives, Frank. I mean, one alternative is negotiate a deal, and the other alternative is for NATO to go to war in Ukraine openly, which means sending troops. The Macron idea, but in multiples. There's no stomach for that in Europe, other than Macron, and even he's backed down a bit. Maybe the Poles would like to do it, but they don't have the capability. So I think the real situation is there has to be a negotiation sooner rather than later, because every day goes by, the Russians make more gains and they're going to have greater demands. And so why wait for the inevitable awful result?
And what does that look like, Steve, that negotiation? How do you envision that?
That's a good question, Frank, because there's a territorial issue, for sure. And there's a policy issue, which I think is more important to the Russians even than the territorial one, and that is the question of NATO's presence in Ukraine. They want to guarantee there won't be any NATO in Ukraine. That is absolutely clear, I think, from their position. They've said it many times. And that's, in a sense, the easiest one to give in a way, because, you know, you can trade that for territory. So there's a possibility of some kind of negotiation, but, you know, the Washington has opposed it all along, and the Europeans themselves have opposed it to a certain degree. So it's going to be tough to do it, but I think it has to be done.
Let me ask you about a question that has loomed in all of this, and I think is vexing Europeans especially. Our colleague David Satter has been on the show recently talking a bit about it from the perspective of somebody who, you know, has been spending a lot of time in Europe these days, knows Russia very well as well. And that is Putin likely to be satisfied with whatever territorial arrangements have come out of such a negotiation? Or do you think this will simply constitute a pause en route to presumably more of Ukraine coming under his thrall, and possibly others, including maybe even those Baltic states that are now NATO members?
Yeah. Well, nobody knows the answer to the question. That's, you know.
But you don't know. But what do you think, Steve? And what are the implications of it? If
I think the Russians are tired. I think they have taken heavy losses. It's not a popular war in Russia, because war is not popular with Russians. They don't like it. And they've suffered from war, you know, and the memory, the collective memory is strong. So I think they would like to end it and, you know, return to normal, so to speak. But they would like to be, you know, I think the important thing to the Russians, even though they say it isn't, is that they would like to have relationship with Europe and even the United States, if it's possible. That's what they're after, but not on the basis of putting NATO next to their, you know, next to their territory. They don't want that. No. But if they could
got that
find it,
the Baltics as well.
Well, you already have that, yeah. But Baltics are small potatoes from a military point of view. They don't have an army of any importance. The key thing about the Baltic states is that, you know, the Russians occupied them for a long time. There's no love lost between those sides. But I don't see the Russians having any interest in pushing into the Baltics, because what would they get? They would get endless headaches, that's all.
Well, theoretically, they could get a war with NATO as well. If they were
well, that's automatic.
That's supposed to happen, right? Automatically.
Yeah, well, we'll see. But I mean, I don't see, I just think the Russians, the real equities for the Russians is to have some reconciliation with the NATO problem and some reconciliation with the West. because what Putin's goal is, and he said it even yesterday, was, well, they want this, the Russian economy, to be one of the great economies of the world. Well, they can't be without having those relationships and trading, you know, products and normality, so to speak.
Unless this is certainly what they've been, living off of, and some would argue thriving from, is the relationship with the Chinese and maybe the BRICS bloc that it's continuing to do business with.
It's carried them through the war. There's no doubt the Chinese have provided them critical parts that they couldn't get anywhere else. But is it and they sell oil and they sell stuff to the Chinese, but that's not enough. You're not going to modernize your economy that way. I think they want to modernize their economy.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. They certainly seem to have modernized their military in all of this, the militarization of.
Yeah, but they always did. They put all their nickels in that.
But that's certainly true. Going back to our time together in the Pentagon,
right? Exactly.
We know that.
I mean, I always wondered when the Soviet Union collapsed, the only thing that really was left was the military industry.
Right.
The rest of it was pretty much shot.
Kind of, I think a sort of Chapter 11 reorg.
Absolutely. Yeah. But they were able to do it.
And Steve, I did want to say, I think the role that you played in the Reagan takedown of the old Soviet Union by depriving them of some of the technology that was so critical to their military capabilities, as well as commercial.
Yeah, but now we have China, which can give them technology. So
certainly do. Yeah, and that's part of what makes me very anxious about predicting where Putin goes from here.
Because yeah, but I think that he has to look at
the Chinese.
Yeah, but he has to look at his country's future.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's not a stupid man. He's a very brilliant guy.
He's not.
But not always on the right side.
I just have to tell you, I've always had the feeling that it's a kind of après moi le déluge feature to this guy. What the Chinese are going to do to his country is eat it, I think, in due course. So it's a very dangerous.
Well, that's our big problem, I think, much more than Russia.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. China, for sure. Steve, I did want to ask you very quickly. You've spent a lot of time studying the Middle East. I know you defer to your wonderful bride, Shoshana, for her expertise on all these things. But just a quick question. Talked a little bit about it with our previous guest, Chuck DeVore. This idea of the United States putting a port in Gaza seems to me to be very fraught on many different levels. What are your thoughts? And I ask you in part because, one of the great pieces of research that our Center for Security Policy did 3 decades ago was arguing against putting American troops into places like the Golan Heights. And I think it's a similar kind of deal here. Your thoughts?
Israel doesn't need the United States in Gaza.
For sure.
The U.S. policy is a mess.
Must.
Well, that's the problem, Frank. I mean, you get the impression that the administration is trying to save Hamas. Mm-hmm. And that's awful, just plain awful. I think this is the worst policy I've ever seen from the United States on the Middle East. It's a complete disaster.
I concur. And Steve, there was a stunning strike by Israel against Iranians, who are obviously calling shots on all of this
in Damascus,
in a diplomatic compound. They're going to get raked over the coals at the UN Security Council today.
It was an adjacent building, but okay.
But in their compound, apparently. But the point these guys that they're up against have endlessly used.
Well, ask the simple question. How come there were 3 top Iranian Revolutionary Guards generals and a bunch of senior officers in Damascus? What were they doing there? Were they having tea?
They were running the war, is what they were.
Damn right they were. They were getting ready to help Hezbollah and the Syrians and everybody else attack Israel. So this was a very smart move by the Israelis.
I think so, too, and necessary. Steve, Brian, thank you. We have to let it go with that for the moment. Appreciate the work you do with us at the Center for Security Policy. Support that work at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Talk to you soon. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The loss of 7 individuals tragically killed by Israeli forces while feeding Palestinians in Gaza has prompted other aid organizations to suspend operations until, we're told, they are satisfied it's safe. Memo to all such organizations, Gaza is not safe. It is a war zone in which local and foreign civilians are at unavoidably some risk. That's substantially because Israel is fighting an enemy that intensifies that risk by using such civilians as not just human shields, but as weapons. The more killed, the better for the information warfare Hamas terrorists are counting on to survive. There are only two ways truly to end the suffering of non-combatants in this war. Hamas can unconditionally surrender or be decisively defeated. Any other outcome is a formula for far more death and destruction of innocents throughout the Middle East and, inevitably, here. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and my friend and very admired colleague, Jonathan Emord, is in the house, I'm pleased to say. Jonathan is a constitutional attorney, the author of The Authoritarians, and a candidate for the United States Senate from my Commonwealth of Virginia. Jonathan, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Listen, there's so much to talk about and not a whole lot of time, but I would like to visit with you first and foremost about something that I know troubles you as a constitutionalist, as it does me. And that is the idea that the Biden administration is very aggressively helping to bring about, namely that we'll replace our constitutional form of government, limited, representative, accountable, with something they call global governance, using the World Health Organization as kind of the vanguard of the effort to undertake what Barack Obama famously called the fundamental transformation of America. Am I misstating what's afoot here?
No, not at all. The World Health Organization is really an agent of the CCP, and the efforts that are being undertaken. That's right. And the efforts that are being undertaken are really designed to replace American sovereignty and individual patient doctor-patient relationships with mandates coming through the World Health Organization on the pretext of an emergency, whatever they wish to declare an emergency in the health areas, and then expanding that power through the CDC and the Public Health Service to control the practice of medicine in America. In ways really that will be detrimental to our survival in the next several years. And the reason why I say that is that this is a replacement of independent professional judgment by physicians with bureaucratized medicine directed by the World Health Organization. Senator Tim Kaine has introduced legislation to provide the infrastructure within the United States for implementation of this. Many people are unaware that he has introduced legislation that would enable the Public Health Service to receive in real time the prescriptions that are given to patients, their medical histories, at every level of government. The Public Health Service would get it. So local, state, and national. And also will empower the government to determine the extent to which individuals are complying with the prescriptions, and also enable the medical authorities, including the medical boards, to comprehend whether or not a physician is following the mandates. So this is the destruction of what we have known as the greatest means by which medicine has worked for Americans, and that is through independent professional judgment. And so now you're going to have, if you didn't like Medicare, if you didn't like the extent to which the government has controlled the provision of medicine through Medicare, which is I call mediocre care, you end up with that in spades when it's run effectively by an enemy of the United States through the World Health Organization, with your own government being a patsy for an accomplice.
Yeah.
For implementation of it.
Accomplice seems to me to be more apt. Jonathan, this is such an important point. And of course, Senator Kaine is your opponent if you win the primary and get into the general election. He's also, I believe, a man who went on the record in connection with an amendment that Senator Ron Johnson offered last year to ensure that the United States Senate would advise and consent to any such accord coming out of the World Health Organization, especially that has so fundamental an impact on our Constitution, to say nothing of, as you say, our medical freedoms. What do you make of this? I have to say, having worked in the Senate 40 years or so ago now, it's unimaginable to me that Democrats like my old boss, Senator Scoop Jackson, to say nothing of Harry Byrd and, Robert Byrd, Robert C. Byrd, would contemplate allowing any such radical initiative to be blown through without, at the very least, a proper debate and a vote. But that may not even be in the offing, let alone, you know, preventing this kind of thing from coming to pass in the first place, about 54 days, as I recall, from right now.
This is a just one of several examples of the extent to which the administration and those that are in the Democrat leadership in the Senate reject the Constitution. They reject the Constitution's limits on centralized government power. They favor absolute control. And as a result, in this instance, they will not even allow the constitutional process of advice and consent in the Senate for what is indeed a new treaty relationship, whereby for the first time in American history, this is a substantial change, the World Health Organization, an international body, will be able to exercise influence and control directly over the practice of medicine in the United States. And that is an abdication of their constitutional oath of office. And in addition, it is a clear sign of the extent to which they are willing to sell out the United States in favor of this globalist agenda.
Yeah. Jonathan, as you may know, the state of Louisiana, the Senate there, adopted last week, I believe now, unanimously, on a bipartisan basis, a bill that would essentially preclude the application of anything that the WHO comes up with, and among others, by the way, in the state of Louisiana. This strikes me as an important expression of another aspect of this that I wanted to ask you about. Is my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that the enumerated powers granted the federal government under the U.S. Constitution do not include health policy. And yet we have the situation here where those powers, therefore, being reserved to the states, the federal government is in the process of surrendering powers that it doesn't even exercise in the course of this this World Health Organization global government gambit. I want to ask you to respond to that on the other side of this very short break, but I did want to just establish, is there a real constitutional problem here in that respect as well? Jonathan Emort, we'll be right back with more. Stay tuned right after this. We're back. And Jonathan Emord is in the house. He is the author of a terrific book entitled The Authoritarians, which describes the rise of this phenomenon from the 19th century to the present. It's very much underway, I believe, in connection with this idea of creating a new global governing arrangement, ostensibly for health purposes, keeping us safe from pandemics and the like. But Jonathan, as you've said, this is a power grab. It is anti-constitutional, and it should be rejected on those grounds alone. But it's more than just the infringement on our personal medical freedoms, I think. What about states' rights? Are those being impacted here as well?
Yes, as you point out, there is no federal power that provides for the ability of the federal government to control the practice of medicine. The practice of medicine has historically been understood to be intrastate activity, and the Founding Fathers included no provision in the Constitution that would enable the federal government to assume control over the practice of medicine. Recognize virtually every doctor-patient relationship is quintessentially an intrastate affair, in that the doctor is supplying information and recommendations predicated on that doctor's understanding of the unique characteristics of a citizen of a state within a state. What they want to regulate intimately, such that they can control what a doctor recommends to you, as well as what prescription you've been supplied, as well as whether or not you have fulfilled the prescription. In other words, they want total direct government access and information as to each patient in this country, for the first time invading your privacy rights, invading the province of the states, and ensuring a centralized bureaucratic control over the practice of medicine, likes of which we have not seen to this degree. But, and this is a huge increase. And then when you tie that in with the World Health Organization, you've got a situation where we are transmitting the most intimate information about each person to an agent of the CCP, and therefore, of course, to the CCP. So if you're an enemy of the United States like they are, you want to know about our vulnerabilities. What better way to comprehend how vulnerable we are than to determine the physical characteristics of each patient and what vulnerabilities they have and how they can be exploited? And this doesn't take too much forethought to figure out what they're going to do with that information in the long-term plan to destroy the United States.
Yeah. And it's personal, isn't it? That's your personal information that could be exploited for such purposes. Jonathan, thank you. I appreciate your vision and clarity on this issue of the World Health Organization. Folks, I want you to take note of all of this, if you would. At centerforsecuritypolicy.org, there's a take action item on our homepage that will take you to the Sovereignty Coalition, which is really an incredibly important effort to expose what's afoot here and enable you to take action. Action is needed now, especially to communicate with your elected representatives, one of whom in the future may well be our friend Jonathan Emord, but for the moment, there are people like Senator Kaine who are in need of correction on this World Health Organization business. Jonathan, let me turn to another constitutional matter. Like you, one of our, I believe, most distinguished constitutional attorneys and practitioners is John Eastman. He's a personal friend as well as a very, you know, admired colleague. He has been now sanctioned by the California Bar Association after an excruciating 35-day trial that seems to have been characterized mostly by misconduct and unfair treatment, needless to say. Talk a little bit about this case, if you would, and how you think it is likely to impact the kind of counsel that even people like a former president of the United States could get. I guess at the time he was actually president of the United States, if this kind of decision is not successfully challenged.
So this is an example of the weaponization of the bar. We've seen the weaponization of justice by the Department of Justice against Donald Trump. And this is a similar type of situation, but by the bar. It is a tragedy, because if you insist on political correctness, if you insist on depriving individuals of the representation that they seek and are due with independence, you, of course, create this environment in which there is intolerance of any political deviation from what is considered to be the orthodoxy of those in power. And here it is a far left agenda. And so John Eastman is, of course, a very famous individual who has stood strongly for constitutional values. And as a result of that, it seems he's being persecuted. And the result of that can mean that there's an interorum effect. It not only violates your free speech rights, it also violates his right to defend the Constitution, stand for its principles, and act against those who cause us to be deprived of our constitutional rights. So it's a quote unquote cleansing of the bar, begun with him as a good example, so that they will then be able to create uniformity in thought and in action and in adherence to specific liberal agenda items. And that's what's happening. It's a crushing blow.
And will have a chilling effect, I think it's fair to say. I hope it will be reversed on appeal. Jonathan, we've got about a minute. I just wanted very quickly, as a man of faith, as well as someone who obviously has a reverence for our government, what are we to make of the conduct of the White House in the course of the Easter holiday to lift up this transgender cause?
It's outrageous. What he's done is he's substituted a far left political agenda for a religious holiday. So in effect, he's created a new establishment of religion. He's elevated what is a political cause in favor of transgenderism above a religious holiday that has been, you know, this is the first time in American history in which this has happened. This is the first time that any president of the United States has rejected. Not only he's removed all the religious symbols from the White House, he's rejected religion in favor of transgenderism. I don't know how someone who calls himself a Catholic can easily do that, but he did it. And then in addition, he has sent the very wrong message, which is that politics can prevail over religion in America and the government will back it.
And on top of it, I think a layer of cultural Marxism to boot. It's an abomination. Thank you, Jonathan Emord. Come back to us soon if you would. Thanks to the rest of you. Join us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.